The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of magic and wonder, if you know where to look. And I'm obsessed with looking for it. I'm Simon Sinek, and I host a podcast called A Bit of Optimism. Each week, I have a short conversation with someone who inspires me or teaches me something about life, leadership, and other curious things. I hope you'll join me on the journey. Listen to A Bit of Optimism on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, a couple of questions. One, how's your health?
Well, funny you should ask. Because, I know you're a person who takes health issues very seriously, and I'm going to give you an exclusive.
Okay.
Because Gary Kerfers told me a long time ago that I should pay attention to Bob Letsetz, and I think that was even back when you were on the Velvet Rope in those days.
Okay.
But, over the Memorial Day weekend, I had a heart attack. I had been feeling this. The impression I had was that I had really bad heartburn for a lot, and it was coming and going for a couple of days. Like it started on a Wednesday night, and then Thursday it was coming and going. And so I said, this is really uncomfortable. I'm going to call the doctor. And I set up an appointment for Friday morning. Very good doctor said, this has all the earmarks of an ulcer, but you don't seem like the ulcer type. So let me real quick take a blood test. We'll rush it and we'll see what's really going on. So 2 hours, he said, you go home, lie down. I'll call you. 2 hours later, he called me. He said, Chris, you got to call 911, get yourself to the hospital. It seems like you might be having a heart attack. I thought, oh, wow. Because I'm 69. My father died of a heart attack at age 67. So I thought, oh, I beat it. But no. Anyway, I went to Fairfield. I went to Bridgeport Hospital.
Right.
Went to Bridgeport Hospital. The cardiology team was waiting. They tested me for COVID-19 to make sure I didn't have that. And then they wheeled me right into it's not a surgery room. It was like one of these micro surgical things where they go in through your wrist and look at everything on video monitors.
Oh, yeah, that's the way they do it now, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, there's just a little tiny dot on my wrist where they went in. So they found blockage in my lower coronary artery, and they cleared it out, and they put in 3 stents. And 3 days later, I was home, resting up. But I got to tell you, I feel good, and very grateful to the good people at Bridgeport Hospital.
So what's the rehab?
Well, changing to a more plant-based diet, for one thing. I was a guy who, I'm a bon vivant, you know. I love to eat, but I've lost 17 pounds since that happened, maybe 18. I didn't weigh myself yet today. And I mean, I was too heavy, it's true, and I probably liked meat more often than I should have done. So anyway, I'm going to change my diet. I'm going to relax, you know? Let's face it, I've got it made. I don't need to like sweat like new records or new anything like new tours. They're not happening anyway. So I'm going to relax and enjoy the fruits of my labors and my life. And I was sort of doing that already, but now I'm really going to do it.
Now, since your father was 67 and he died of a heart attack, had you been tracking this closely?
Probably not as closely as I should have. I was getting warnings, you know, from blood work and stuff. But I don't really like that anti-cholesterol medicine, although I'm taking it now.
Which one are you taking?
Crestor.
Right, I take that one.
Yeah. And, you know, the statins have their pros and cons, but my cardiologist is a really good guy, and I'm going to just follow his advice and keep taking it until the numbers are such that I can consider easing off.
Are you taking the ubiquinol with it?
I don't think so, no. Is that a supplement?
Yeah, it's a supplement. It's supposed to speak to the side effects. It's not CO2, but without going to the other room and looking up, it's something like that. And are you having any side effects from the Crestor?
Not too bad. Actually, none so far.
Right.
I mean, I know the side effects can be, one is depression, another is memory loss. I really don't want that.
Well, the number one, I haven't had any issues with that, but with some of the statins, I have had the leg pains. You know, you get the muscle tightness.
Yes. Yes, I've heard about that. I haven't had that, thank goodness. But I didn't want to, you know, talk about health the whole time, but since you started off with that question, I thought I better...
Welcome back to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. We started, as I say, we got an update on Chris's health, and he says that's fine for everybody to hear, so we're going to leave that in. In any event, my guest today is drummer for Talking Heads and Tom Tom Club. He has a new book, Remain in Love. It's going to be in stores, both in the UK and the US, on July 21st. Please welcome Chris France. Chris? Okay.
It's a great pleasure to be here, Bob.
Okay. Now, Chris, why the book? Why now?
Well, I'd been meaning to write the book for many years, like a dozen years or so. And then a couple of years ago, I finally buckled down and said, you better do this, you know, because you're not getting any younger and nobody's writing any good books about talking heads. So I did it. I started about 2 years ago. And, you know, I feel like my story is a delightful one. And I feel like I was very fortunate. And I feel like, well, I feel like it's a memorable tale to have been in Talking Heads, to have been in Tom Tom Club, and to be married now for 43 years to Tina Weymouth. Look, I'm a lucky guy, you know?
Okay, one thing anybody who reads the book will be stunned about is not only is it comprehensive in terms of the timeline, the detail is really incredible. Did you have any notes or did you just remember all that?
You know, most of it I remembered. But fortunately, you know, I've been kicking myself for a long time for not keeping a journal. I knew during that time that I should be keeping a journal, and I just didn't. But Tina, fortunately, had these, not a journal, but date books. Like, you know, like the calendar book, date books you buy at the Metropolitan Museum that has King Tut on the cover?
Right.
She had one of those, and she would write down, last night we played the Roundhouse. sold out, three encores, got paid. and she also made notes of the hotels and things like that. Like, bed was terrible, or shower was too small, things like that. So I was able to, Tina loaned me her date books from those years. I guess it was like from 1977 to 1980. And they came in very helpful, because a lot of the information you get on the internet is a tissue of lies.
Well, that begs a question. Once you wrote it, I'm sure you ran it by Tina. Did she remember things the same way you had?
In most instances, yes. Although once in a while she would say, oh, no, it wasn't like that. And she has a memory that's very keen, you know.
Okay, let's go back to RISD, Rhode Island School of Design. That's where you and Tina went to college. According to the book, David dropped out. Why go to RISD to begin with?
Well, I was planning on having a life as a painter. And I had been in bands when I was young, a teenager. And I loved being in bands. You know, I started off in elementary school, and then the Beatles came out, and everybody had little rock and roll bands. And
okay, well, let's slow down a little bit there. So you were playing in bands before the Beatles?
Yes, actually, I was playing in my elementary school band before the Beatles.
Okay,
yeah.
Let's cover something. So you're originally from where?
Well, I'm originally from Kentucky, but during my formative years, we moved to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which is where my father was from. And he was going into a law practice, so we moved back to where he had some connections. And so elementary school, junior high, and part of high school, most of high school, I was in Pittsburgh.
Okay, now Pittsburgh is very hip again.
Yeah.
What do I know about Pittsburgh? You know, there's the book, Michael Chabon, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, which I recommend. The darkest movie I've ever seen in a theater, Mrs. Soulful in Pittsburgh. But when you were growing up in Pittsburgh, was it a shithole or was it an unknown hip city?
Well, I couldn't wait to get out of there, to be honest. I knew that Pittsburgh was not going to be where I was going to make my mark, because I wanted to be an artist. And I thought, God, Andy Warhol wanted to be an artist. He was from Pittsburgh, but he had to move to New York, you know. And don't get me wrong, I have a lot of good friends still in Pittsburgh and fond memories of the place. But I just knew as an artist, it wasn't happening for me.
Okay, but you had to get out of there. But you said, so you went to prep school for part of your high school?
Yeah, I went to a Shadyside Academy, which is a fine school in the suburbs of Pittsburgh.
And so you still lived at home at the same time, or did you live there?
I lived at home. I was a day student. And that's where I started painting. I had a great studio art teacher named David Miller. He went on to teach at Skidmore. But anyway, he turned me on to contemporary art, which was something I didn't know anything about at the time. Like, he turned me on to Jasper Johns, Rauschenberg. I knew about Warhol. People like Ed Kienholz and Klaus Oldenburg and, of course, Willem de Kooning. You know, he turned me on to all these artists, and I thought, wow, this is what I want to do. And that's why I went to RISD.
Okay. Those are all, generally speaking, abstract painters. Prior to this teacher, Mr. Miller, did you have an interest in art? Did you draw? Did you paint? Anything like that?
I did draw. I was born in Kentucky, and have my whole mother's side of the family in Kentucky. So I used to draw horses and stuff like that, or my grandfather, you know. And I would draw on those shirt cardboards that you used to get.
Absolutely.
You know, when your shirts were laundered. I never really thought of myself as being an artist at all until I took that class called Studio Art in high school. And all of a sudden I thought, this is what I want to do.
Okay. So you said you were in the elementary school band. Is that where you learned how to play, or did your parents give you lessons?
Yeah. I started off on the trumpet, and it wasn't really happening for me. I was trying. I was practicing, but I wasn't getting anywhere. And I had a very good teacher. His name was Gene Wilmoth. He was a mallet instrument guy, you know, marimba, vibraphone, xylophone, and also piano, and also drums. And he said, yeah, I can see it's not really working out for you, but you have a good sense of rhythm. What do you say we switch you over to drums? And I said, cool, let's do it. And he gave me the little rubber pad and the elementary book of rudiments, and he gave me a couple lessons, a little private lessons, and next thing I knew, I was first chair in the drum department.
Now, in the school band, you're just playing the marching drum, whatever they call that, right? You're not playing a whole kit.
Yeah, there was no drum kit. In the fall and the spring, you would do marching, and so that would be a marching drum. In the winter months, we would have orchestra. And I would hit a snare drum or a triangle or a tambourine. One time I played just the cymbal, just the ride cymbal.
And so what happens when the Beatles arrive?
So the Beatles came and just basically changed everything overnight after their Ed Sullivan appearance. And I remember the day after that, the girls on the school bus were singing Beatles songs in unison, and they knew all the words and everything already. And I thought, wow. So a bunch of my friends and I, who were in the school band, just took the stuff to our garage and started playing. We didn't just play Beatles. We played like The Ventures and Dave Clark 5. And what else? Well, we in my first band, which was called The Lost Chords, we actually had a trumpeter and a trombone in the band too. So we could play Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass songs. It was really fun. We never really accomplished much other than having fun, but, you know, fun is the best thing to have anyway. So...
Yeah, so like the Beatles song. So did you ever have bands that had gigs in high school?
We had one gig with the Lost Chords, and that was at the Presbyterian Church Youth Fellowship Hall. Can you imagine a straighter gig than that? And it was really fun. The kids went nuts, and we had a great time. But mostly we just rehearsed in either my garage or my friend's basement or, you know, a lot of rehearsing.
So you go to RISD. At all times, maybe in history, being a fine artist is a challenging career. Did that occur to you?
Yes, it did. One thing they tell you when you go to art school is, you know, there's no guarantees. Some people say you can't even teach art. And, well, the fact is that some people can and some people can't. But RISD didn't have any, like, program that you could enroll to get a job after graduation. It was, you're on your own now. Good luck.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, but you played in bands in high school. It seems, based on the book, that very soon after your arrival at RISD, you were interested in forming a band.
Yes, my second year. First year, I didn't play any drums at all, any music except, you know, on my record player. But I was really missing it. And so I asked my dad if he would drive me up to Rhode Island from Pittsburgh with my drum kit. And he said, yes, sure. So we brought the drum kit up, and the first band I joined was, in fact, a soul band. I mean, a real soul band, and called the Brotherhood. They were all from Boston, from Roxbury, Boston. But one of them went to RISD, the trumpet player. And so he asked me, would I play with them? And we ended up, again, rehearsing a lot. And I must admit, I was the weak link in that band, because the rest of the guys were Berklee School of Music guys, you know. But eventually I got it. And I love soul music. The challenge for me was the slower tempos. You know, the slow tempos are, for me, more difficult than any fast tempo. So it took me a while to get it together with the Brotherhood. We did one show, which was the RISD Spring Dance in the what they called the refectory. And it was a great celebration, very celebratory, and the band sounded good. And then that was it. That was the last gig with them.
So you have your drum kit, you're in Providence. What's the next step?
Well, the next step, I was just playing by myself a lot with records. And Tina Weymouth was kind enough to let me keep my drums at, or to invite me to keep my drums at her place, which was, she was living in a little carriage house near Brown University. And it was right by the tennis courts. So nobody complained about the noise. And I would play along with the latest Marvin Gaye record, or the latest Brian Ferry record, or the latest, you know, Goat's Head Soup by the Rolling Stones or whatever. And I would try to keep in shape doing that. But eventually one day a guy came to me, a friend said, Chris, I'm making this film. He was a film student. I'm making a film about my girlfriend getting run over by a car. and I need some really cacophonous music. Do you think you could help me with that? And I said, sure, I'd be happy to. And I said, bring your Nagra tape recorder over to Tina's carriage house and we'll do it. And he said, okay, I'm going to bring another guy too who plays guitar, a friend of mine who plays guitar. I said, great. So he brings this guy over with his tape recorder and he says, Chris, this is David Byrne. And so David and I sat down together and Mark's instructions were, I want this rising cacophony, you know, crescendo, crescendo, and then diminuendo. So we said, okay, we can do that. And I think we got it in the first take. And I had this dream about starting another band at RISD since the Brotherhood had kind of gone kaput. And I had imagined, you know, David Bowie had just come out and Lou Reed had this hit with Walk on the Wild Side. And there was a lot of rejuvenated interest in the Velvet Underground by art students I knew. I thought, we should start a sort of Velvet Underground-ish band. And I asked, I had this dream that we could have a band that would entertain our friends, you know, no higher aspirations than that, really. We weren't thinking about records or anything. And I said to David, I'm thinking about starting a band. Would you like to be part of that? And he said, yeah, I think so. And so we started a band called The Artistics. And we had loads of fun.
And did you have any gigs?
We did. Our biggest gig was the Rhode Island School of Design Valentine's Day Ball. And we played that. And that was very exciting for us. We played they had lowered the drinking age to 18, so we had a bar at RISD called the Tap Room. And we played in the Tap Room. We played a couple private parties. And just before we graduated, we played outside across from the RISD Museum on Benefit Street in this little park on a nice afternoon in May. And that was our final show.
And who was in the band at that point?
It was David, myself, a friend of mine from Kentucky named David Anderson on guitar. He's a painter now. And Hank Staler on bass. Hank was running PS1 in New York a while back, which is an art museum. I'm not sure what he's doing now. But we would have guest appearances by one of our friends named Tim Beal was a sax player. He would sit in from time to time. And we also had our friends Mark and Naomi, who they were a couple, and their song was "My Baby Must Be a Magician." So we would play "My Baby Must Be a Magician," and Mark and Naomi would sing it duet style. We had a ball.
And how often would you rehearse?
Three times a week.
So you were taking it seriously. Let's stay at RISD for a second. How did you meet Tina?
I met Tina. She came riding down the street. I was sitting on the grass in this little park, and I saw this beautiful girl coming my way on a bicycle, a yellow bicycle, old three-speed style. And she rode past. She didn't look at me or anything, didn't notice me. But I was sitting with a male model at the school, like an artist model named Charlie. And Charlie said, I said, whoa, Charlie, did you see her? Wow. And Charlie said, that's my friend, Martina. Charlie called everybody his friend, you know. And I thought, I got to meet her. And the next day, I had a figure painting class. It was the beginning of the school year. I had a figure painting class taught by a guy named Richard Merkin, who you may know his work from The New Yorker or other places. He was actually on the cover, one of the heads on Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Right, with a mustache
and a hat.
Right.
Because he was friends with Peter Blake, good friends with Peter Blake. So anyway, Richard Merkin was teaching, and it was the first class of the year, and I looked over, and there in the corner was Tina Weymouth setting up her easel. And so that's where I met her.
Now, how deep into your career at RISD? This was what year?
This is my second year.
Okay.
She transferred in from Barnard. So she was a new kid.
Okay. Now, one thing that comes up in the book frequently is other men hitting on Tina. Okay. A, how did that make you feel? And B, why do you think, or what's your insight into Tina that she stayed with you? I mean, obviously, there are a lot of stories the opposite. If nothing else, Michelle Phillips and the Mamas and Papas.
Oh, poor Michelle. I was always okay with these guys who I could tell they were coming on to Tina because somehow I felt secure in my relationship with her. Secure enough that I didn't have to be jealous. I think there might have been one or two times before we got married where I felt a little jealous of some guy or another. But once we were married, which was in 1977, I felt confident that I didn't have to worry about such things.
Okay, you graduate from RISD. What year is that, 73?
74.
74. Then yeah. What's the plan?
Then the plan is I went home. I painted a mural. The plan was to move to New York, but I knew I had to have a little money in my pocket to move to New York. So I went home to Pittsburgh and through my father's connections, I got a job painting a mural in a hospital, the Ioneer Hospital of Pittsburgh. And the mural had already been designed by some other guy, and I was supposed to blow it up and make it huge, which I did. And it took a long time up on a scaffolding, you know, on a stairway. I got, I think, $2,500.
Wow, that's a lot of money in 74.
Yeah, and so I had enough. Then I thought, okay, I can move to New York now, which I did in late September. And, or maybe it was early October. It was early October. And, David had agreed to move to New York. And he moved there before I did. And Tina had agreed, and the three of us got a loft together on Christie Street, which I found after much searching around New York. And Tina's brother, who's an architect, said, "Chris, don't bother about the Village Voice. Don't look in there. Look at the industrial section of the New York Times on Sunday." So I said, "Okay." And he was right. That's where he found the good lofts, you know, that nobody lived in yet. And we got a nice one on Christie Street, just below Houston, on what is called the Lower East Side. And it was three blocks from CBGB's, maybe three and a half. My friend who lived across the street from CBGB said, "Chris, there's something going on over at this club across the street. You got to check it out." And I went in there and I checked it out, and there was like nothing happening at all. It was in the middle of the week. But there was like four guys playing pool in the back. I went back there, and they were Latino guys. And one of them was wearing like a shark skin suit and a tie and had a real sharp crew cut. I thought, So I asked him, you know, what's going on? Is there going to be any music tonight? He said, in a very heavy Mexican accent, no, man, not tonight, but you come back on the weekend. The Ramones will be here. And I thought, oh, a Mexican band. How interesting. And well, I came back on the weekend. The Ramones were there, and I soon found out they were not a Mexican band. Well, what else would you like to know?
Well, no, what I guess what I'm asking is, when you, David, and Tina moved to New York, is your plan to be a painter or a rock and roll musician?
Well, David and I hoped to be rock and roll musicians, and because we felt like, you know, we're young, we can do this while we're young. If we don't succeed, we can be painters or, you know, whatever, conceptual artists, whatever we want to be, and we'll still be considered young painters at age 40 or whatever. We kept in touch with the art world. We were very, you know, closely knit with the art world. And in fact, a lot of people that came to CBGB's to hear us and the other bands play were artists of various types, you know, people in the visual arts, people in the performing arts. You know, Philip Glass would come to see us, you know.
And at that point in time, he kind of already was Philip Glass, right?
Yes. Well, it was early on, but he already had a very high reputation downtown. Yeah.
So what is everybody doing to stay alive?
I had a day. We all had day jobs. Mine was I was a stock boy and shipper for design research, which we sold fancy European furniture and housewares. And it was really fun because the store was full of all these beautiful shop girls, you know, sales girls. And we also sold Marimekko clothing from Sweden. So they all wore those striped Marimekko t-shirts. And there were a couple of poets that worked with me down in the basement where we would unload things off of trucks. And then after they got sold, we put them back on the trucks. it was a good day job. Nice people.
And what did David do?
David, a friend of ours had resigned. A friend of ours got a job at the Museum of Modern Art, and he left his job at an ad agency, also on 57th Street. We all worked on 57th Street, which is so funny. But so David would help make ads for people like Prince Machiavelli and Sergio Valente and things like that back in the 70s. And Tina was working at Henri Bendel, which was a very exclusive, only recently went out of business because of Trump's, you know, screwing up Fifth Avenue, and they lost all their business.
Okay, was David actually designing ads?
No, he was operating a stat machine, you know, photographing parts of the ads and putting them together.
So how does Tina become a member of the band?
I had actually asked Tina to become a member of the band when we had the Artistics, when we were forming it. And she said, oh, no, no, no. That's a guy's thing. I'll support you in your efforts, but I don't want to. No, she just felt like it was a bad idea. And but I kept after her because I felt like the band I was forming with David was going to be a very different type of band in terms of appearance and also sound. And we weren't going to be like copying The Who or The Rolling Stones or even The Velvet Underground, really. we were going to be more unusual than what people might have anticipated. You know, we were trying to be different and interesting. And I knew that Tina shared a similar aesthetic artistically, that she got what we were trying to do even before she, you know, started playing with us. And also, I knew that she had a fantastic sense of rhythm from dancing with her and just, you know, embracing her. And, you know, when the records come on, when our favorite songs come on, we would dance, you know. And I knew that she could, you know, really feel the rhythm. So I kept asking her, and I kept asking her, and she kept saying, no, 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 not a good idea. It's a boys' club. But then one day, she walked into the loft with a Fender Precision bass that she'd been putting down like $5 a week on for months, evidently. And one of the happiest days of my life.
Well, I think she may have been the progenitor of female musician bass players in terms of rock bands. I don't remember anybody playing that role before that. I'm sure people email me.
Well, there was Suzy Quatro was
of course.
Well, I had a couple of Suzy Quatro records, and on one of them, she even kind of looks like Tina. And I said, Tina, look at this. And of course, there's a great Carol Kay, who session bass player, who Tina admires greatly. And I'm sure there were plenty others. But yeah, Tina was one of the first down in lower Manhattan to do it.
Okay. Now, Tina is in the act when you finally play CBGBs?
Yes. Yes. Our first gig was in May of 1975.
And how did you get that gig?
I walked in and I asked Hilly Crystal, the owner, I have this band and we'd like to audition. And he said, what kind of music you play? And I said, well, we play in a style of our own. And he chuckled like, he'd heard that one before, I think. And he said, okay. You know, he had a very basso voice. He said, okay, I suppose I could put you on in front of the Ramones. And I said, all right, we'll take it. And that was our audition night, which was, I think, 3 days later. So we had to think of a name. We didn't even have a name yet. So we had to think of a name. And one of our friends from RISD was visiting us at the time. He now has a job at the Art Institute of Chicago. But anyway, he said I was reading TV Guide, and they have a glossary of television technical terms, and one of the terms is talking head. It means the most boring but also the most informative format of broadcasting. So we thought to ourselves, talking heads, talking heads. That sounds good. And we could relate to it because it didn't connote any particular type of music like heavy metal or country or, you know, hard rock or disco. Talking heads, it could be anything. So we went with that name. And we put, Tina and I had little T-shirts made that said Talking Heads on it. And we walked through Washington Square Park with it on, and people would say, are you guys in a band? Things like that. And so we thought, this Talking Heads name might work out. And that particular shirt of Tina's is now in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which is kind of sweet.
Now, if you read the book, you find out essentially you met everybody. But in that scene at CBGB, of course, the guys from television, people from Blondie, etc., did you have the feeling that this was, in retrospect, of course, it was really percolating a big scene and almost all of those acts got record deals, some went on to great success. Did you have that vibe when you were a member of it?
Yes. I had the impression that it was, it started off really small. And even then, with television, Patti Smith, Blondie, the Ramones, ourselves, a band called the Mumps, even when there were only 25, 30 people in the audience on a given night, I had the feeling that something was getting really cool and good, and that CBGB's was going to be like an incubator for a scene where bands could sort of play their original songs, and maybe they would not even get through the song without making a big mistake or something. But the audience was so small that not that many people would notice, and there was no internet. So you could make a mistake. You could have a very awkward performance and still come back and do it again the following week. And so it was that kind of scene. And everybody was kind of, just learning how to do this, how to be a performer. Patti Smith was a pretty good performer right from the get-go because she had been doing poetry readings and things, and she had a lot of charisma. But as more and more people came and the bands got better and better, and all of a sudden you had people from like Japan and London and Hamburg, Germany, and people coming up from Atlanta, and it just started to be a very exciting scene. And there would be lines outside to get in. And I felt like very fortunate to have been in the right place at the right time.
Now, needless to say, as you referenced earlier, Talking Heads has a unique sound. Did it resonate with the audience? Did you generate fans from the beginning?
Some people didn't get it. I think some people still don't get it. But, the kings of downtown New York rock at that time were the New York Dolls and the various spinoffs of the New York Dolls. And we liked them. They were real cool and everything. But we certainly weren't going to be parading around in platform shoes and like purple trousers and stuff. So there were some people that we were so contrary to the New York Dolls aesthetic that they didn't really get us at first. But then eventually, even some of the people who really didn't get us came around.
Okay. So how did Jerry get in the band?
Well, Jerry Harrison was in the Modern Lovers, which was a band that we greatly admired and played their record a lot. Their record was produced, it was actually a demo produced by John Cale that was later released as an album. And we had been listening to that. And I went home to Pittsburgh one time, and one of my mother's friends said, Chris, my nephew is in a band in Boston, and they're really good. And I said, who are they? What's the name of the band? She said, oh, the Modern Lovers. Now, I knew that the Modern Lovers had broken up. Evidently, she didn't know it yet. But I said, oh, what's your nephew's name? And she said, Ernie Brooks. I said, oh, the bass player. She said, yeah. And she gave me Ernie's contacts. So I had Ernie's contacts and went back to New York from Pittsburgh. And I the next day or a couple days later, I was in a restaurant owned by Mickey Ruskin, who founded Max's Kansas City, but this was called The Local. And one of the cooks was Julian Schnabel.
That's unbelievable. I saw that in the book.
Yeah. And they were famous for their hamburgers and their red wine. So we were having a hamburger and a red wine, and Tina and David and I. And I looked across the room, and who should I see but Ernie Brooks? I recognized him by his big head of curly hair that he had on the album cover. So I walked over and I said, "Hey, Ernie, I was just talking to your aunt in Pittsburgh." And he said, "Oh, yeah, the Scheuers, Liz Scheuer." I said, "Yeah, exactly. And she's a friend of my mother's." And she said that I should get in touch with you. So here I am. And he said, "Well, what's happening? What are you guys doing?" And I said, "Well, you know, actually, we're looking for a third member of the band, somebody who can help us, you know, fill out the sound and make the songs more beautiful." And he said, "Well, what instrument are you looking for?" I said, "Keyboards, maybe keyboards and guitar." And he said, have you thought of Jerry Harrison?" And I said, "Wow, I would love to get in touch with Jerry Harrison." And Ernie gave me his number. So I called up Jerry. And Jerry said, "Well, guess what?" He said, "This is very interesting, but guess what? I just enrolled in a master's program for architecture here at Harvard." And besides that, the breakup of the Modern Lovers was a very difficult experience for me. So I'm not going to rush into anything, but I'd be interested to hear you play. So I said, "Okay, we'll plan a gig up in Boston, and you can come hear us play," which we did. And one thing led to another, and when we finally had a recording contract, Jerry said, "Okay, I'd like to join the band." He had played with us a few times before that, you know, so we knew that it worked well.
You know, you mentioned that he's a single child in the book, and he's at Harvard. How difficult was it for him to drop out?
You know, I never asked Jerry how difficult it was, but he did that. I think he did one semester, or maybe even did a full year. He might have done a full year.
Welcome to season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question is going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun, and I can't wait for you to hear it.
Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, "Oh, that's not the line. Oh, that's not this. Oh, it's not that." And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, how do you get a record deal?
How did we? We had people approaching us, offering us record deals. And, you know, I can think of three off the top of my head. And one of them was Seymour Stein of Sire Records. And we had made a couple demos, and we listened to back to these demos, and we thought, we're not ready yet. This is, you know, we can rock CBGBs, but we're not going to, like, rock the Billboard charts sounding like we do now. And we knew that if we put out a record too soon and it wasn't up to, you know, it wasn't happening, then we might not get a chance to do one. We might not get another chance. So we were very careful. Seymour offered us this deal, and we made him wait for a year and a half, 18 months. And the poor guy, he was so nervous that some other record company was going to snatch us up in the meantime. But we knew, we had a feeling about Seymour and his company, Sire, that they were independent, that they were in New York, that their offices were in a townhouse on West 74th Street. And we could, according to Seymour anyway, we could go there anytime we wanted and talk to him. So we thought, that sounds a lot better than some guy in, you know, L.A. or at the top of a skyscraper in New York who, you know, we can't even get in to see him. So we decided to go with Seymour. We asked Danny Fields, who was managing the Ramones. We said, Danny, what's your experience? The Ramones were on Sire. And Danny, what's your experience with Sire Records? And he said, well, Chris, in a nutshell, Seymour's always done right by us. And that was like all I needed to know. Danny also said, you know, no record company is perfect. With any record company, you need somebody to tell them what to do. but Seymour has always done right by us. So we signed a deal with Seymour. And I'm really glad we did, because it worked out great.
Okay, so you make the first record. Needless to say, the first record sounds very different from what came thereafter. Talking Heads 77, were you happy with the result at the time?
Yeah, I was. I'm still happy with the result. It's a very sweet rich sounding album. I think my way of thinking about it is it was a great start, a great beginning. And I when I listen to it today, if I listen to a song like Don't Worry About the Government or Psycho Killer or Pulled Up, I think, wow, we were really something.
Okay, so the first album comes out. Do you have a feeling there's momentum?
We had momentum in sort of like the big cities, but we didn't have any worldwide momentum. And I remember looking at the charts and thinking, we're not really doing that great. But the fact is that we were making a big impression and establishing a reputation for being artists, you know. We had the sort of like the best world we could possibly have. We had some commercial success, not a huge amount, but enough that we could make another record. We had artistic success, which was validated, you know, by The Voice and the New York Times and by our friends. And we also had, we had enough financial success that we could give up our day jobs.
And that's a very significant thing. Staying with business, traditionally the drummer is the business guy in the group. Was that the case with you in Talking Heads?
You know, that's what Gary Kerfer said to me. It's always the drummer who runs the band. Well, I think all of us had a pretty good business sense, but maybe I was the person who was comfortable talking to people about it. But it got to the point after not very long that I realized you can't manage your own band. You have to have somebody else do it for you.
Okay. Now, the first record makes an impression. Second record is a whole new thing. You work with Eno. You do a cover of Take Me to the River. Tell us the genesis and the story of making that record.
Well, we were on a big tour of Europe and the UK with the Ramones. And when we came to London, Eno came to see us. And we met with him. We had a nice lunch with him. And then we went to his home. And we talked about, you know, music, basically. And one thing led to another. And we decided Eno would be a good producer for us. And Eno was interested in doing it. And so that's how we got involved with Eno.
And at the time, though, he hadn't really worked with anybody significant. He'd been in Roxy Music, and he'd done his own solo albums, correct?
Yes. He had also done, just around the time, right before we worked with him, he was working with David Bowie on the...
On Low.
The Low trilogy, and also with Devo. He produced the first Devo album, which he did in Germany. And maybe the record companies weren't thrilled that we were working with Devo instead of, like, you know, Roy Thomas Baker or somebody like that. But he was right up our alley. He was our kind of artist. And we had his records, we collected his records, we admired his work. And so he agreed to do it. Now, on that second album, More Songs About Buildings and Food, we had already been performing all those songs live. And some of them we had been performing for years live, but they didn't make it onto the first record. So, and we had been touring like crazy. So when we got to the studio at Compass Point in the Bahamas, which was delightful, all Eno had to do was like set up the mics, and then he could treat the various instruments, mostly the drums, but sometimes other instruments, with this little briefcase synthesizer he had. And by treating, I mean putting effects and delays and things like that on the instruments. And that was his main contribution. But he also helped, like when we came to Take Me to the River, which we'd been playing kind of up-tempo, like Al Green's version is quite up-tempo. But Eno said, you should slow this down. You should play this as slow as you possibly can without making a mistake. And so we thought, okay, we'll try that. And we did it, and it was super sexy that way. And so that was... of course, that became a hit, and it was our first hit. And the whole experience down at Compass Point was just super cool, and everything went smooth, and we had a wonderful time.
Well, it's interesting in the book you talk about Take Me to the River, that ultimately there's sound where you feel like it's underwater, which is, that you describe that. I've always felt that, you know, with the guitar, you know, during the solo part. Okay, the record becomes a hit. How does that change you and the band?
Well, I don't know that it really changed us. It just made we were able to get paid better by nightclubs. Because we had a song that was on the radio, so we could get, you know, more money. wasn't a whole lot more, and it wasn't a whole lot of money, but it was like better than we had been doing.
And who was booking all those tours?
In those days, it was a guy named Stu Weintraub at William Morris. And Stu was quite a character. But I think Gary Kerr first.
Who, of course, was your manager.
He was our manager, and I think he pretty much directed Stu. Now, Stu, we're going to play here, here, and here. You get on the phone and book it. And we played everything from college campuses, universities, to pizza parlors and supermarkets that were out of business and were empty. We played all kinds of crazy venues, which later we were followed by Blondie and by Elvis Costello and by The Clash, because there was no circuit for bands like us. We weren't very big, you know. We weren't like Foreigner or something. So a lot of promoters weren't interested. So we had to find these young indie guys to promote our shows. Sometimes we promoted them ourselves.
Really? Even when you'd had the second album, et cetera?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Third album, of course, Fear of Music. And of course, This Ain't No Party, This Ain't No Disco, This Ain't No Fooling Around. It brings you to a higher level. But after the third record is when you start to get wind of the fact that maybe David Byrne is going to go on his own tack.
Yeah. What I found out was that David all along would prefer to be a solo artist. The group was just something that he was a real part of the group. We were really collaborators, and we were friends, and we were, you know, we lived together in the same loft, and we really 90% of the time we agreed on things, you know. We didn't agree on every single thing, but now, Bob, I have to be very careful because I don't want to sound like the whiny drummer who's embittered by the famous lead singer, because that's not the case. I'm not embittered, and I have great respect for David and his talents, which are immense. But I still think that he had his eyes on a solo career from almost day two. Maybe not day one, day two. And, you know, some people are like...
Let's jump forward. When he ultimately does go solo and you form Tom Tom Club, you have a hit. And up until his recent mega concert dancing experience, he's had a lot of ink, but he hasn't had any huge success. How do you feel about that?
Well, all I can say is our first Tom Tom Club album was like magic to me. Chris Blackwell gave it. Now, one thing Seymour did, which I can, you know, make a little dig about, was he offered David a solo deal because David wanted to do a solo record. So then Jerry said, oh, if David's going to do a solo record, I'm going to do a solo record. So he offered Jerry a solo record. And then Tina and I were like, well, what are we going to do? And Gary Kerfurst went to Seymour and said, what can you do for a record deal for Chris and Tina? And he said, I can't afford three Talking Heads solo albums. And so he offered us nothing. And Chris Blackwell of Island Records, who knows the value of a good rhythm section, said, you know what, Gary, I'd love to do a single with Chris and Tina. Have them come on down. He already knew us from our recordings at Compass Point. And he said, have them come on down, cut a single. If I like it, they can do a whole album. So we went down to Compass Point, and we made a record called Wordy Rapping Hood. And he heard that and he said, okay, I want you to make a whole album, but first we're going to release this one as a single. And it went top 10 in about 20 different countries in Europe and Latin America. And, you know, then we had Genius of Love, and Genius of Love was a huge hit in America. So big that, it continues to be sampled by various hip-hop artists and R&B artists. And it was like magic. It was a great, great success for us. And it gave Tina and I, you know, I think people realized, oh, Tina and I aren't just like David's little friends. They actually have ideas of their own. And I think people realized that Talking Heads was actually more of a shared experience. The art of Talking Heads was more of a shared experience than one particular guy's ideas.
Okay, but throughout the book, certainly you say at some point that you believe David is on the spectrum. But he does do some very interesting things. You said he dropped out of RISD after 1 year. He left his significant other wife after being inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame literally that night. But the most interesting thing on a business level is you agreed that you would split songwriting credit along with Eno. Tell us about the songwriting credit and who really wrote those songs.
Well, the songs were created by the five people who were in the studio working, mostly created by Tina, Jerry, David, and myself from improvisations in the studio. And then sometimes Brian would be playing something in the control room while we were out in the studio. But more often than not, he was listening. And he would add things later, but the original basic tracks that all those songs on Remain in Light come from were improvised by the four musicians in the studio. Then we took Brian and the engineer mainly arranged the different jam sessions that we did so that they would evolve into different parts of a song, like an A section, a B section, a C section. And then we would do some rough mixes of those, at which point David was expected to write lyrics, because at a certain point, actually pretty early on, he said, I want to be the one who writes the lyrics. I don't want to sing anyone else's lyrics. So we're like, okay, cool. And we all knew after those Compass Point sessions on Remain in Light that we had something very extraordinary. And he said, you know, this is so extraordinary. I can't just write like something off the top of my head. I got to live with these tracks for a little while, and then I'll be able to write something. So we said, great. We understood that completely. And I think he rented a car and drove around the country listening to cassettes and of the basic tracks, and also listening to the radio with evangelical preachers and whatnot on the various regional radio stations. And he came back with some great lyrics. And at that point, Eno helped arrange some of the background vocals and the and actually, I think he wrote, for example, the melody to Letting the Days Go By, you know, the chorus of Once in a Lifetime. And he made major contributions. Long story short, when this great album was finally finished and we got our advance copies, Tina and Jerry and I, and we're looking at them, and the agreement had been that it would say music by, in alphabetical order, David Byrne, Brian Eno, Chris France, Jerry Harrison, and Tina Weymouth. But instead it said, music by David Byrne, Brian Eno, and Talking Heads. Well, I thought David was a member of Talking Heads, but anyway, you could see that the rest of us were being treated like sidemen all of a sudden, as if we hadn't really contributed to the extent that we had. You know, so we had to deal with that. Brian wanted the front cover to say "Remain in Light" by Talking Heads and Brian Eno, and we're like, oh my God, how are we gonna talk him out of this one? And Gary Kerfirst went to Brian and he said, you know, Brian, there's gonna be a 9-month promotional tour behind this album. Can you do that tour? And Brian said, oh, no, Gary, I couldn't possibly do that. You know I don't tour. And so Gary said, well, then, how can we advertise it as Brian Eno and Talking Heads if you're not there? And, well, that ended that problem right there.
But despite the credit, in terms of publishing royalties, did you get 1/5?
No.
Really?
No, I did not.
So what was the final split on the payment?
You know, I prefer not to get into the details because off the top of my head, I don't exactly know what they are. I have a good idea. But, you know, it didn't work out the way it was supposed to work out.
How about on all the other albums?
You know, are you talking about performance royalties? Or
I'm talking about publishing royalties.
Publishing royalties. Well, I'm afraid David gets the lion's share of most of that.
But you do get some.
Yes.
Now,
yes, I do.
It's like it's almost like Godfather 3. It looks like David's out of the band, and then you and Tina always seem to find a way to get him back in.
Yeah. Well, you know, you have to use psychology. And we learned that if you make David think something's his idea, it might get done. And so, what can I say? I think every rock band who's been around for a while has many twists and turns and ups and downs, and we had our share too.
Okay. After True Stories, do you say to yourself, and then Naked, do you say to yourself, this is ultimately done? Or do you always have a hope that, well, we'll do it one more time?
I always had a hope that we'd do it one more time, yes.
And has it ever come close?
I wish I could say yes, but I don't think so, no. A couple of times I got my hopes up, but lately I'm kind of resigned to the fact that it's not going to happen. Although Talking Heads has a great career on Broadway now. There's some great Talking Head shows, songs being performed on Broadway.
So have you seen David's Extravaganza in person?
I have not. I confess I have not. Had I been invited to the show, I probably would have been happy to go. But no invitation was extended, and I didn't want to just drop in.
And How often or when was the last time you actually spoke face-to-face with David?
I spoke face-to-face with David for the last time in 2003. So it's been a good long while. We communicate by email, mostly about, you know, what songs can be used in what movies and what, you know.
When was the last time you had an email from him?
Oh, probably a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, so after Talking Heads is behind, Tom Tom Club continues to go, but also you and Tina start producing records.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Well, it kind of, we hadn't really planned on being producers or anything, but our good friend Alex Sadkin, who was an extraordinary engineer and producer for Bob Marley and third world, and he ended up producing or engineering and mixing things like I Want to Know What Love Is for Foreigner, you know, big hits. He was he had worked with Bob Marley, and he was scheduled to produce Ziggy Marley and the Melody Makers, Bob Marley's kids. And he was down in Nassau at Compass Point working with some band when, tragically, he was thrown from an open-air Jeep. They had an accident. He was thrown, hit his head, and never came to. So suddenly, Virgin America, which is a brand-new company, they needed producers for Ziggy Marley and the Melody Makers. And Tina's younger brother, Larique Weymouth, was a young A&R man there. And he said to Nancy Jeffries, and Nancy Jeffries was in charge of the Ziggy Marley and the Melody Makers project, he said, Nancy, have you thought about using Chris and Tina? Because, you know, they love reggae. They know a lot about, you know, island culture and stuff. Maybe they would be good. So we got a call from Nancy Jeffries, and she said, would you be interested in doing this? And we said, yeah, we would be interested, because Talking Heads wasn't touring at the time or anything. And we went down to Jamaica to meet Ziggy. First we met his mother, Rita Marley, in a sushi bar in New York. And she said, okay, you guys seem cool to me. And she remembered meeting us before somewhere. And she liked our Tom Tom Club music, Genius of Love. She loved that. And she said, you got to come down to Jamaica and meet Ziggy. So we met Ziggy, and we flew down there. And Ziggy said, yeah, man, you can do it. So we started working with Ziggy. The first day, he said to me, this was at Sigma Sound in New York, because we thought if we produced the record in Jamaica, things might get kind of out of control. We should have it here in New York. And so we did that. And the first day Ziggy came to me, he said, Chris France, how come you bring your wife to the studio, man? I said, well, Ziggy, first of all, Tina knows more about music than I do. And second of all, she's going to be a great producer. So just sit back and enjoy it. And in fact, it went very well. That record did great. It was called Conscious Party. Another new signing to Virgin America at that time was Keith Richards. So Keith Richards came in and played on a song called Lee and Molly, which is about a interracial relationship. And he was really cool. And we had Hugh Masekela come in and arrange background vocals for a group of Zulu women, young Zulu women who were in town doing a musical called Serafina. And Baba Olatunji dropped in. A whole lot of Jamaican dance hall artists stopped by to see what was happening. And the record sold like millions. So it was a wonderful experience.
Okay. So needless to say, Talking Heads doesn't make another record. You have success with Tom Tom Club. So for the last 25 years, how much of that was working? How much of that was rest and relaxation?
My last 25 years? Well, I've taken plenty of time off, I assure you. We like to go sailing. I know you like to ski. When our kids were younger, we spent a lot of time at Crested Butte.
Oh, great.
And loved it there. And of course, also in New England. But as you know, out west is kind of more fun, especially
absolutely
in the middle of winter. We spent a lot of time sailing because we love to sail. But we've also done several Tom Tom Club albums. And we've done plenty of Tom Tom Club tours, sometimes with a package, sometimes just on by ourselves. The last time we played was, I think, 6 years ago. You know, nobody's breaking down our door for a new Tom Tom Club album, but we're okay with that because we've already done some good stuff. And we're more active in our community here in Fairfield, Connecticut than we used to be. And we enjoy that. Tina was not too long ago inducted into the Connecticut Women's Hall of Fame.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
It's a big deal. And I mean, she's in really good company there. And then I decided I would write a book, and that was a couple of years ago.
Okay, well, obviously you've had this health blip, but are you sailing into the sunset, or do you, in the back of your mind, is there some artistic project that you still want to cook up?
Well, Tina and I have been encouraged by what's happening with electronic music today. I'm not referring to the kind of music you necessarily hear on popular radio. I'm referring more to an underground thing, and we dig the underground life. So we're thinking that a few years back we did a record for a label run by the Chicks on Speed. And they were friends of ours. They're from Holland, they were at the time. And they said, "Would you do we're going to do this album called Girl Monster with all girl artists." Well, I know I'm not a girl artist, so we put Tina's name on it. And it was very well received in an underground way. And so we thought, well, maybe we should do like an electronic duo where it's just Tina and myself, some electronic drums, some keyboards, some bass, and some vocals. And we don't have to have a big production. It can be very minimalist. We don't have to have a big stage show, because maybe we won't even go out on tour. Or maybe we will, and we'll have some, you know, interesting little stage production that doesn't necessarily look like a rock and roll show. So we're thinking along those lines. I'm also thinking about writing a book about my beagles, because they travel with us everywhere. Poppy has crossed the Atlantic 24 times.
More than most Americans. And are you painting at all?
Well, that, you know, my son, Egan France, is doing the painting for the whole family right now. He's really good, really great. He's got a show up in Berlin starting next week, I think. He's in Art Basel.
Right.
He's serious.
And what about your your daughter?
Oh, we only have two boys.
Oh, the other, okay.
His name is Robin, his nickname. He's an electronic artist, and he's got his own label called Kraft Jerks, like Kraftwerk, but with a J and a Z, Kraft Jerks. And he's on his, like, I don't know how many releases, 20? 12-inch vinyl. And they sell, you know, they're small batches, but they sell. And he also, lately nobody's performing live, but he also performs live as Kid Ginseng, as a DJ.
Okay, now, needless to say, the musical landscape is littered with people who are of household names and have no money. In your particular case, are the royalties and the sinks keeping you comfortable?
thank goodness, yes. Tina and I were very fortunate, and we had a few good years, and we socked some away.
Good to know. Okay, Chris, I think we've covered the basics. If you want to go into much more detail, needless to say, learn much more about the New York scene and what it was like to be in that and to be happening in the late 70s and early 80s, certainly read Remain in Love, Chris's memoir, out on July 21st. Chris, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure.
Till next time, this is Bob Lefsetz.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of magic and wonder, if you know where to look. And I'm obsessed with looking for it. I'm Simon Sinek, and I host a podcast called A Bit of Optimism. Each week, I have a short conversation with someone who inspires me or teaches me something about life, leadership, and other curious things. I hope you'll join me on the journey. Listen to A Bit of Optimism on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.